you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
And now we have a king. I don't want an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a D? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Shout out! Revolution! Shout out!
Police Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
Welcome, welcome to this edition of the Three Left Show from my apartment. Not in the studio, but recorded at home. Go figure. So, this episode of Three Left Show, I'm your host, Dan Platt. This show's for going a different direction. We discuss socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts. And read different articles to give you a more complete picture of a particular issue. This time, I'm going to focus on police reform. That's a hot topic for once, but it's also something that I was actually going to cover in time anyway. I'm always ahead of the curve, it's just a matter of getting around to it. But otherwise, all the ideas are there. So, let's see. I don't have a particular launching off point. Oh, no, I do. So, let's start with the situation at this time towards mid-June 2020. From an op-ed from Kathleen Johnstone, like reading her, bombastic op-ed writer, basher of the establishment, because there is a different kind of binary one can use when it comes to politics. Are you pro-establishment or anti-establishment? Usually no one says they're pro-establishment, but usually the forces of reaction or conservative sentiments are usually pro-establishment, no matter how otherwise they like to present themselves as. So, as the George Floyd protests rip through America, the mask of free liberal democracy slips away. This is written at the beginning of the month. Kathleen Johnstone is an independent journalist based in Melbourne, just so you know. Starting with the article, what is happening in the U.S. is a head-on collision between the story the establishment tells Americans about their country and the reality. This disparity has been stretched to the breaking point. I have a bedtime story for you. Two narratives. Once upon a time, a brave nation liberated itself from the tyranny of the British Empire and birthed freedom and democracy into the world. With the help of heroes like abolitionists, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X, it overcame systemic racial inequality, and now it is a shining exemplar of human rights, the respected friend of free democracies around the world, and the hated foe of all tyrannical regimes. It is not without its faults and its past mistakes, but it is the best leader and protector of the liberal world order that we could possibly hope to have. But here is a different narrative, the waking up story for you. Once upon a time, a nation rose to prominence after emerging unscathed from two world wars which damaged the infrastructure of its competitors. The world's major power players quickly coalesced around this new superpower and began maneuvering other nations into a tight, empire-like alliance with it. With a long and grueling Cold War, this empire succeeded in toppling the world's only other superpower and began working to absorb all other nations into an alliance with it. If nations resisted, they were subverted, sabotaged, and attacked until they either collapsed or allowed themselves to be absorbed into the imperial blob. World-spanning power structures are now centralized around this nation, which is home to the largest population of billionaires on the planet and the mightiest military force in the history of civilization. An unfathomable amount of power revolves around this nation, so mechanisms have been put in place to ensure the stability of its own status quo. These mechanisms include the most sophisticated system of propaganda ever devised, an Orwellian network of domestic espionage, increasing internet censorship, and above all, a highly militarized police force. The operators of this globe-spanning empire have always been acutely aware that the weakest point of their machine is the possibility that the hundreds of millions of people who live in this nation may one day decide that the imperial status quo is not serving them, and that they do not want to be ruled anymore. They know that the last line of defense against this happening is their ability to use extreme violence upon the population until they stop revolting. So they have no intention of ever giving up this ability. An entire planetary empire depends on it. Now, if you've been hearing the bedtime story your whole life, but not the waking up story, you would naturally assume that demanding an end to police brutality was the most reasonable thing in the world. You would naturally expect that if a police officer was caught on video deliberately strangling a man to death and then was not immediately arrested and prosecuted for murder, people would be understandably outraged, and drastic systemic changes would be swiftly implemented to appease their anger. You would naturally expect the shining city on the hill to side with the people over a police force's murderous tendencies. If you've heard the waking up story, you would expect no such thing. You would understand that racial disparities never left the nation in question, and that the establishment, which still keeps J. Edgar Hoover's name on the FBI building, has no intention of doing anything about the police force's role in it. You would understand that the role of the police is not to protect and serve the people, but to protect and serve the empire, in the exact same way that this is the role of the military. You would understand that the empire is no more likely to voluntarily dispense with the violent tactics of its increasingly militarized police force than it is to dispense with the Air Force or nuclear warheads. In fact, as an aside, we've pumped another $1 trillion into modernizing our nuclear capabilities. To supply all the empty words and take-a-knee photo ops you like, but actually voluntarily disarming themselves against their subjects is not something they're planning on doing. This does not mean that those demanding these changes are being silly or unreasonable. Demanding that the police not murder you is the most sane and reasonable thing in the world, per what the police force purports to be, and per what America purports to be. It's not that neither the police force nor America are what they supposed to be, or pretend they are. The bedtime story and the waking up story could not possibly be more different. Now, of course, if you're kind of a moderate, maybe you consider both to be true, or that there's a little bit of truth in either one, or that both of them are exaggerations of true narratives. That is what we are witnessing here. We are witnessing the head-on collision between the story America's political, media, and educational institutions tell Americans about what their country is, and the reality of what their country actually is. The disparity between the bedtime story and the waking up story has finally been stretched to a breaking point, and now the mask of free liberal democracy is coming off in front of everyone. We are watching a population besieged by institutional racism, economic hardship, and a pandemic virus finally pushed past the breaking point, and finding themselves crashing headlong in the most unyielding part of a planet-sprawling empire. The stories are slowly clearing from the air like tear gas, and the cold, hard reality is becoming exposed to a greater and greater segment of mainstream America. And now the leader of this nation is openly threatening martial law, trying to designate Black Bloc protesters as terrorists. Video footage of police brutality is saturating social media faster than people can watch it. First Amendment violations are sweeping from coast to coast as police chiefs, mayors, and governors try to see how far they squeeze freedom of assembly laws, and mysterious armed men in fatigues who refuse to say who they're with are patrolling the nation's capital. Prison riot specialists are being recruited as expert consultants because in their eyes of the empire, the prisoners are rioting. We are all watching from around the world as citizens of the hub of the empire confront their oppressors and increasingly battle of wills. The violence rips apart the thin veneer of narrative that was keeping the bedtime story intact all this time. We all watch as the tattered ribbons slowly fall to the floor. Whoever controls the narrative controls the world. The empire is losing control of that narrative. In the long run, this can only be a good thing. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. The truth is always superior to fiction. Yada, yada, yada. Moving on with the how does this movement shake out, my first thoughts that I'll share is the comparison to Occupy, rather, or the differences. So there's quite an argument right now about what the demands of the movement are, should be, particularly what they should be. So there's the different levels, right? This is the three left show, not the two lefts or the one left. And how radical or revolutionary you consider yourself, or how much you really want to get at the heart of what causes these problems. So the narrative of the waking up story is that we live in an empire, right? A nation that is built on genocide, slavery, crimes, and various wrongdoing that has not been accounted for, meaning, say, no reparations to new Africans, meaning black people, no full autonomy and support for reservations and First Nation people. In fact, even now, they're still continually being exploited, their lands being ripped up for resource extraction or the transportation of said resources. You know, it continues. Even in the, you know, the bedtime story that we've made mistakes in the past, but things, you know, we're doing our best. Well, I don't consider us to be doing our best, and I don't think it's increasing number of people who believe that, yes, you know, we're doing our best to be the holder up of civil and human rights. Although, of course, when it comes to Democratic Party or establishment circles, that narrative would still hold true. But to get to the heart of it, you know, we're an empire. This is the militarization of the police is a necessary part of upholding this status quo with the inequality and the racism and everything else. So how deep you think the problem is, of course, then how do you react, right? Considering Johnstone's point of view with the waking up story, if you hold that narrative like I do, then abolishing the police as it is, a full transformation, just as all of society needs to transform in the decades to come, is the goal. Defunding is then a medium step. It's a way of opening the door to all kinds of possibilities. Let's say, like in my Tri-City area, we've compiled the stats. I looked into them when I ran for mayor, that the city I live in spends 30% of its budget, roughly $50 million, on policing. It spends 3% of the budget on parks. And the same goes for the cities of Troy and Schenectady, the Tri-City area, Capital District of New York. Troy, in fact, spends half of its budget on policing. And Schenectady also a 35%. No, actually, no, they were lower. It was 25%, 1.5% spent on parks. But it was a similar ratio of we're going to spend most of our municipal budget on quote-unquote safety concerns, you know, police, fire, rescue, emergencies, but not, and very little on the daily activities, festivals, art, and things that make life worth living, right? It's the state is the purveyor of last resort, you know, what the market does not provide. And since the market doesn't provide safety and fired service, that's what the city has to do. And it's up to everyone else to pay for summer programs and teen employment, except the market has been really bad at that. And of course, it then marginalizes and keeps entire sections of the population out. So defunding opens up a lot of areas of change. Even just a $5 million out of a $50 million budget can make a world of difference when it comes to renovating vacant homes or fixing up various parks, adding amenities on the streetscapes. But then there's the counter-argument, and this goes to the more revolutionary impulse of replacing everything, slowly if not over time, building dual power, our own community-run institutions, that, you know, if we leave it up to the people in charge, even with a lot of public pressure on them with the mass protests, that they're still going to implement them haphazardly in a way that you know, is as little damaging, quote-unquote damaging, to the status quo as possible. So here's an example from Forbes about how the L.A. mayor is slashing the LAPD's budget as calls to defund police slowly pick up steam. That's the title. It's filed by Jack Brewster. This is from Forbes, the capitalist newspaper, basically. This is the voice of capital, how they react to things, how they talk about things. So, top line. On Wednesday, the L.A. mayor, Eric Garcetti, announced he is throwing out plans for a massive police budget hike as support for slashing police department funds grows among activists in the wake of George Floyd's death. Here are the key facts. As protests continue across the country, some activists are calling to defund police, in quotes, and redirect those funds to other areas such as education and healthcare, arguing police reform is not enough. Black Lives Matter and a coalition of more than 100 other black rights organizations launched an open letter this week calling on citizens to sign such a petition to demand local officials decrease funding for police departments and redirect funds to, quoting, spending on healthcare, education, and community programs. Very vague, nebulous terms, but they take the form of things that communities decide on. Some politicians are listening. The LAPD has set to receive a large increase in its annual budget, from $1.2 billion last year to $1.8 billion for the year of 2020 and 21. Before Garcetti axed that move Wednesday, instead cutting $100 to $150 million, only after activists rallied outside his home. That's definitely more of the militant protest of moving it from the civic spaces where protests is supposed to happen to outside of the homes of those in power. In New York, more than 40 city council candidates are calling for a $1 billion cut to the NYPD's $6 billion budget over 4 years to help fund other programs such as the city's summer youth employment program. In cities such as Minneapolis, Dallas, Philly, and Nashville, similar movements are gaining traction. Now, of course, what I mean by critique of they're not going to do it right, or they're only going to do it halfway, or even in a minimum way, is that cutting $150 million out of a over billion-dollar budget is almost chunk change. Another $100 million, it would be a quarter of $1 billion, so that is much more substantial. So that's why I saw some complaints about this. You know, leaving it up to Democratic mayors will mean they'll cut 1% and say, see, I defunded the police, I cut 1% of their budget. Obviously not what we're wanting. Still, most lawmakers have remained hesitant to the proposal. For folks who say defund the police, I would say that that is not the way forward, says New York City de Blasio. Although I think he has gone back on that. That's what comes from staying in the streets and continuing mass protest on a particular issue. No, I don't believe that we should defund police departments, says Representative Karen Bass, Democrat of California. She is the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Even she does not want to listen to, in fact, her constituents. Shows where her true loyalties may lie. The writer includes a tangent that state and local budgets have been squeezed by the coronavirus pandemic as tax revenue has plummeted and spending has increased. The shortfall could make decreasing police budgets more tenable, some activists argue. I'll go into a more strenuous argument for that, in fact, next. Here's some more background. So this guy is more, this writing style is very just the facts kind of thing, and various quotes. Despite using the defund police phrase, most activists don't want to reduce appropriations to police departments to $0. Now, of course, in a negotiation, you start high. That way, you negotiate to an actual middle. But reducing it to zero is impractical. Instead, supporters of the movement hope to reduce the responsibilities we ask of police and redirect funds to other social programs. For hundreds of years, black communities have lived under state terror, speak of the devil, be it police or vigilante violence. Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter movement, told The Hollywood Reporter, quote, an abolitionist believes in a world where police and prisons are no longer weaponized as a tool for public safety. Still, there's no evidence that defunding departments will work to reduce police brutality. We are still in the advocacy stage, says David Kennedy, director of the National Network for Safe Communities at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, The policy is still yet to be, or the trend of what the policy will be of what defunding the police means, but the general scope, as maybe you could get from this, is that it is about reappropriating the spending priority. Instead of protecting property, how about we actually invest in more property? Instead of punishing crime, how about we center victims? That can be a lot cheaper, actually. And it calls for a different skill set, a different type of reaction from government. Instead of arresting, instead of users of violence, they could be teams of peacemakers, social workers, and such. Surprising fact, according to the Nonpartisan Urban Institute, they'll be mentioned again later, spending as a percentage of direct general expenditure by state and local government, police spending has remained consistently at a just under 4% from 1977 to 2017. The national average salary for an officer is $67,000, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. However, the salary of a police officer can vary widely depending on the state. Here in New York, that's quite different. Let's see, a crucial quote from Garcetti called the Floyd protests a movement to change who we are in America when it comes to Black America and our criminal justice system during a daily news briefing this week. Now, the true revolution is a system that cares about nonviolence. That means not dealing with violence with violent responses, but peaceful ones, whether they be antisocial or not. But the whole point is to say that the wards of the enforcers of the law are acting like a gang, like a bunch of bullies, like criminals, or in antisocial ways, ways that harass people, whether it be with traffic tickets or traffic stops, not in fact fighting crime or protecting people in that matter. Because there's so many other ways to actually create peace in communities, and they usually involve social programs and doing things over a long term. Includes investment, includes social work, etc., etc. Another piece on defunding the police from Apocalypse Soon, mostly looking at the impending climate collapse or the ongoing crisis of climate change. And this is filed by Kate Arnoff. Defunding the police is good climate policy. Before that, I want to circle back to how Occupy, one of its weaknesses, as stated by public conversation, was that we did not have a demand. That is because, as a movement, it was about calling out the system as a whole and pointing out its illegitimacy. The encampments and the assemblies and the activism in the encampments and the protest of the system as a whole was not for any particular reform, because the core group was who had an analysis and a point of view that this system is not worth fixing, or that rather attempts to fix it will be met with stonewalling, counter-reaction, and the like. So the best thing to do is then just do your own thing, build your own institutions, act as if you're already free. Free of this empire of state control, of taxes, and whatever. That's what the park and, let's say, CHAZ, the autonomous zone in Seattle, is modeling. It is not modeling complete independence of the system, of course. But it's a model of independence from the usual way of doing things. So the food, the electricity, and so on is still part of the grid. But the governance structure, the attitude towards political change is completely different. It's not asking the government to do something for you, since so much else of our political situation is about saying that mass politics doesn't exist. The finance sector is what manages things. You know, we let the market decide. Otherwise, if we let politics decide, it's going to be biased, because we're picking winners and losers, or one ethnic group over another, the one that's better organized, the one that's louder. So to avoid that stuff, and from that point of view, we didn't have a demand. You know, the demand is systemic change or do your own thing and think differently. So it was a consciousness-raising exercise. But we also knew that as soon as we had demands, we could be co-opted. Meanwhile, movements that do have a demand usually do get pulled into the orbit of establishment institutions, you know, Democratic Party, nonprofits, so on and so on. Conversely, you have the Black Lives Matter movement, or this current moment, and there is a demand, but then it becomes a mishmash argument about how far do you go? And arguments of, we need to pick the right demand to appeal to just enough middle-class white people to make the reforms happen, right? We don't want to scare everyone off of talk of abolishment. But this is the same argument that occurred when it came to slavery. Oh, you don't want to advocate for full abolition of slavery. What will happen to all those black people, right? What happens to them? Where do they go? You know, we can't just get rid of it. It'll be chaos. These were things that were said in the 1840s and 50s. But as militant protest and opposition to slavery began to take form, abolition became the accepted demand, or at least more acceptable. Otherwise, it was always a movement of, let's fight for better slavery, more rights for slaves, less whippings, that kind of thing, better homes. And that's the kind of thing that plays out with any argument between reform and revolution. You fight for the revolutionary goal because that's actually what usually wins out in the end, over the long haul. Transforming the police is, to me, inevitable. It's what has to happen. Asking for defunding the police and slowly transforming it bit by bit, team by team, is how that can happen, especially if you want to avoid some large conflict like the Civil War. But there's also a kind of how things are, things will be, what they will be. You know, a riot will occur. Violence will occur. How much is up to how open others are to change. How afraid they are of their neighbors, right? Afraid of what will happen when things change. And that's where the modeling comes in, right? Doing the Thomas Zone in Seattle, showing that a community can provide security even on a few blocks is worth trying. As well as holding assemblies and creating a political unit there. Still on grid, and the city of Seattle can sweep it out in the experiment at any time, but it looks very nice right now, just like the first month of Occupy. When people start hunkering down and actually trying to create a community that could outlast the situation, go the whole year, you know, actually, like, when they start putting their own power systems up, and then they can start cutting themselves off from the grid, I think that's when things will get a bit more serious. So in Occupy, we want to avoid those demand debates, debates about demands, by not having one. And now we're kind of, we the left, or rather the movement, because the left and the movement are kind of separate, but it's intrinsic that this is left. Right, and this is different than liberal activism or liberal demands. A liberal demand is the racial sensitivity training, banning chokeholds and things that absolutely will kill people, maybe having a taser policy, removing a statue. These are the liberal reforms, right? Not good enough. So here's another overall article about defunding, centering defunding as the main goal here, or at least the achievable one. Going for full defunding, of course, or at least demilitarizing, so taking away the funding for the military gear, the SWAT teams, the armored vehicles, the tear gas. I got a taste of it last week. Budgets are about to get tight. States and cities should direct money to programs that truly make communities more secure. By Kate Arnoff. Published at the beginning of the month. Late Thursday, California's Air Resources Board announced the results of the most recent auction. Now, before I read this one, I actually want to, because I did read this before, actually, it is more about, like, the market mechanisms, the market mechanisms of Californian politics basically failing to produce the necessary cutting of emissions and carbon resources and so on. So I think actually, yeah, it's definitely focused on LA and California. Okay, and it also kind of goes into details of the waking up story referenced before. So similar demands of reappropriating a budget, a people's budget proposed by the Black Lives Matter in LA, which was a framework for hashtag care not cops, allocating just 5.75% of unrestricted funds to law enforcement and policing, as opposed to Garcetti's 53%. Ongoing pressure appears to have an impact. On Wednesday, the mayor announced he wouldn't authorize the increase in LAPD's budget and would move to allocate, now this article says $250 million. Now, the Forbes one said $100-$150. I don't know why that there's a difference in number. Similar demands have taken root around the country. Organizers with the Black Visions Collective and Reclaim the Block in Minneapolis have called on the city's mayor, Jacob Frey, to cut $45 million from the police budget and expand community-led health and safety strategies. Now, this is different than just transforming the police by having what is called community policing, meaning having B cops again. But this is not community control or directed policing, where community slash neighborhood councils or neighborhood associations would then direct police policy of what their priorities should be, beyond just having a listening tour. The movement for Black Lives has long pushed an invest-divest policy platform demanding that investments in Black communities determined by Black communities and divestment from exploitative forces, including prisons, fossil fuels, police, surveillance, and exploitative corporations, which are almost all of them. But the point is, this has always been part of the platform of the Movement for Black Lives since the movement's conception 6 years ago, actually. State governments account for 62% of prison and incarceration funding, whereas 84% of police funding is done by local governments, according to the Urban Institute. There they are again. Amid slowly easing coronavirus shutdown restrictions, sharply rising unemployment, and weak federal support, both state and local governments face budget gaps. Barring federal intervention, there will be a brutal budget fight weeks and months to come. Police departments and prisons are more likely to be spared in the worst of such cuts, while already threadbare safety nets, now on full display in the pandemic, tend to get even thinner. It's a miniature version of the politics that play out at the federal level, where a seemingly unlimited amount of funds are available for new fighter jets, border enforcement, military adventures abroad, but talk of tight belts and austerity when it comes to improving people's lives, the lives of Black or other Americans especially. The kind of Humvees now roaming the streets of American cities to intimidate protesters has long been used to secure U.S. access to oil abroad. Inflated budgets for policing, borders, military are increasingly wielded to beat back climate refugees. As scholars, including Stuart Schrader, have pointed out, the line between foreign and domestic policy has never been as clear as many like to think. If xenophobic governments in Europe offer any indication, the lines between the carceral and climate policy, carceral being imprisoning policy, and climate policy only get fuzzier as the temperatures rise. A 2017 report by the Center for Popular Democracy, Black Youth Project 100, and Law for Black Lives found that spending in major U.S. cities on policing far outpaces that on vital services, with huge chunks of city budgets devoted to outfitting officers as vital services starve. Now, this is an interesting point because to most Americans, or at least property-owning Americans, the police are a vital service, completely necessary. Our experience with the police is mostly negative, right? They haven't solved the crime committed by us. They haven't delivered justice or what have you, especially since when it's punitive and punishing people, it doesn't really feel like justice. It's just revenge. True justice centers victims. And that requires a completely different infrastructure. As they fuel systemic racism, massive police and prison budgets stymie attempts to build a more sustainable society. At the local level, especially the types of climate policy that mayors and city councils have leveraged over are also the investments campaigners in the movement for Black Lives have urged to make communities safer and stronger. This includes affordable housing, rapid bus transit, job programs. Budgets that revolve around criminalizing Black communities, that is, are ill-suited for taking on the climate crisis. Talking about the Green New Deal and large infrastructure projects. An ever-growing number of green groups have released statements expressing solidarity with protesters and denouncing police brutality, white supremacy, and the increasingly warlike rhetoric from the White House. With Democratic and Republican chief executives both likely to lurch toward austerity in the months and years to come. There's plenty of common cause to be found in calls to defund the police and invest in a more generous, democratic, and green public sphere, well beyond the scope of what any carbon pricing measure can accomplish. For green activists, that will mean seeing decarbonization less as a narrow battle for line items that incentivize renewables than as a contest to shape who and what society values in a climate change 21st century. Many, including in the Sunrise Movement, are already making these connections. Black lives really do matter to climate advocates. Defunding the police should too. So this article definitely is aimed at the environmental activist milieu. So this is where, you know, socialism or social programs, social spending, has a big overlap, slash must have a big overlap, with ecology. And defunding and being less dependent on a punitive justice system is anarchistic. So there you go, three laughs. So from there, now I'm going to cover two articles now beyond defunding the police and arguing for that. And, you know, because that's, to me, it's, and to other lefties, it's common sense. That we've been overfunding police and security and protecting property and underfunding the development of said property, leaving it up to the market that only cares for making profits. So I have two articles here, one from a radical place and one from a non-radical source. I find it very interesting. Now, this is still an opinion piece, as it usually is, but Newsweek published an article that is a, if not pro, but for police abolition, called Abolishing the Police is Not as Extreme as It Sounds. Here is How It Would Work. This is written by Quinien No and Raphael Minimo. The movement against police brutality is consolidating around appeals to abolish the police and defund the police. Just this past Sunday, the Minneapolis City Council voted to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department. Now, an aside, this is a promise, right? They can go back, or they can, once the protests died down, but this is where the pressure keeps coming to finish the job. But it's one of those things where it's possible that, and it's expected, that they'll renege a bit, that they'll say that they'll do this, but won't. This is the case with many Democratic city councils and state governments, where a reform is very popular, there's a referendum passed, it's in there, in the public consciousness, it's demanded, but they still don't do it, and they just kind of wait it out until the energy for demanding it goes away, or just their obstinance becomes a, a cause for demoralizing the cause. It's like, oh, well, we tried, but they didn't actually do it, so what do we do now? And then you hold a bunch of meetings about what do we do now? And everyone just is like, well, I guess the next step would be to, arm ourselves and charge city chambers, but we're not doing that. You know, it's too violent. It's only going to lead to, an escalation. You know, we don't want to escalate. We leave it up to the state, the authorities, to escalate. You know, and so it just stops because, well, they won. They won by not doing it. And that's really frustrating, especially when you're a campaigner and you work at something for years and years and a vote's still not just held on it. Now, this article says they voted, so maybe it's in the law, but Just because it's in the law doesn't mean they'll actually do it, you know? It's in the law that New York State needs to equally fund all school districts. They don't. Organizers have been pushing for police abolition for years, but as the calls exit the fringe and enter the mainstream, many are taken aback and concerned. What do these demands mean in practice? A closer look reveals that they may not be as extreme as they seem. Here are some facts. Abuse and corruption have existed in policing for centuries. Calls for the abolition of police stem from the fact that wherever policing is present, so too are cases of abuse. Daily indignities, killings, and trauma are all inevitable consequences of policing. Granting officers the power to kill implies that swearing to serve and protect somehow leads to infallibility, to perfect judgment. But the expectation that officers' high-stakes decisions will never be impacted by stress, fear, or anger is wholly unrealistic. It is no surprise, then, that reform attempts have failed to curb police abuse. Body cams have very little effect on police use of force. More diverse police forces do not reduce police violence. And anti-bias trainings show no signs of making a difference. By the way, all of those statements have links, so evidence is behind it of some type. This is because the cause of abuse isn't bad training, bias, or lack of accountability, even. It isn't a few bad apples. The problem is policing itself. It's the idea that the most problems can and should be solved by armed men and women using the threat or use of violence. Now, this goes to the waking up story that, like, well, you know, things are not exactly as cheery as you may think. It is, we are an empire that have it's a grand alliance of nations, for sure. But it's for a particular purpose, domestic security and profit making. You know, the security to keep growing the economy forever. But alternatives work. The idea of abolishing the police is often met with dismay. It is seen as an extreme and unrealistic demand, one that would leave crime and violence unaddressed. The unease is understandable. Our society is based around the belief that we need authority, that without enforcers, public safety would be in jeopardy. Our punitive culture holds that eliminating violence takes violence. The violence of armed officers, the violence of the criminal justice system, the violence of incarceration. But alternatives to this punitive system exist, and in fact have proven to be far more effective. A congressional study found that opening drug treatment facilities, quoting, result in significant reductions in criminal activity. Selling drugs declined by 78%, drug-related crime by nearly half, and arrests for any crime up to 64%. Meaning that when drug treatment was the main priority, or the only priority, crime went down drastically. Community programs tackling gang violence have also had remarkable outcomes. In communities where interrupters, these are often former gang members themselves, they mediate between factions before or when violence flares up. Shootings and gang violence have significantly decreased when those are enacted or active. Researchers also found that mental health services, both for teenagers and adult offenders, are highly effective at preventing a return to crime. For example, programs giving at-risk youth access to counseling and cognitive behavioral skill building, meaning anger management class, have decreased violent crime arrests by half, while school policing directly feeds into the school-to-prison pipeline. Restorative justice, on the other hand, when done in schools, with its focus on mediation, face-to-face talking, dialogue between offenders and victims, provide a viable alternative. At Oakland Middle School, suspensions declined by almost 90%, with expulsions declining to zero. Now, declining implies, statistically speaking, that this took place over time, right? It wasn't just 1 year, it wasn't some immediate trend. It took, you know, 5 years of implementing it, doing it grade by grade, class by class, and then this is the current result. These programs and myriad others have one thing in common. They do not involve policing. They do not use weapons, patrols, or surveillance. The task of building safety is shared among social workers, counselors, medical staff, psychologists. Many are members of the community itself, People who understand the conditions that give rise to crime, who do not see offenders as mere criminals, but as neighbors, as humans. Of course, the deeper cause of crime and violence must be addressed. Inequality is the best predictor of murders, violence, and other crime. So any long-term solution to our social woes must be anchored in building a more equitable and just system. And I want to add, as far as fighting white supremacy and racism itself, this is something all of us have to do. It's not on those at the bottom of the pyramid to fix the inequality, right? Because the inequality is systematic, right? Those that benefit from it are responsible for it, if not more responsible for it. So if there's graffiti or property damage, and the knee-jerk response that I see from very well-meaning people and liberals is, you know, that's not constructive. Why don't they do something else? Why don't they do something to fix up their own community? Why aren't they acting politically? You know, this is not the place for a political message, or this is not a good political message. This isn't a political message it just looks ugly. Like if it's graffiti, a tag, or if it's property damage, that's certainly not constructive. It's only causing harm. But it's like, it's not just up on them to do it right. We all have to do it right. And doing it right means working towards a more equitable and just system, as this writes. To me, that means fighting for socialism. It means fighting for anarchism. It means fighting for ecology, the three lefts. It means developing your radicalism. You know, what are you willing to do? And I have lines that I've yet to cross. Abolishing the police does not mean firing all police officers overnight, or that crime and violence should go unaddressed. It means accepting that our punitive approach to crime has been ineffective and that it inevitably leads to abuse, police or otherwise. Abolishing the police means removing policing as an omnipresent force in our society. It means looking at crime and violence as symptoms of deeper issues, responding not with the baton and the gavel, but with healthcare, education, and community. Now, the usual kind of, let's say, not obfuscation, of course, but the whatabouts is that, you know, it's kind of a, and this is the argument made for the crime bill by Democrats like Biden and Clinton's, that when the gangs are out there causing mayhem and robbing people, they have to be taken under control before we can do anything else, before we can do that equality increasing thing and that that equity program. But look at what has resulted from that line of thinking and action. 30, 40 years of increasing spending on prisons, security, surveillance, and policing, and less spending, a million cuts, and everything else. So, looking backwards, how sincere was that line of logic of we have to bring the violent under control with violence, and then we can help them? But the help never came, or it came in very specific ways inside the prison system instead of in the communities, in the places where the public gang violence is happening. So this article brings up the divest and invest strategy, also brought up by the other article. As police abolition advocacy group MPD 150 writes, don't ask me what that stands for, sure, in this long transition process, we may need a small, specialized class of public servants whose jobs it is to respond to violent crime. But this is a small fraction of the work of building safety. Situations that require expertise would be handled by specialists and the appropriate community organization rather than armed men and women. For example, mental health crises should be handled by mental health professionals and medics, not police. In fact, police holding that role have led to an epidemic of police shooting at people with mental illness. After outrage over heavy-handed arrests for failing to comply with social distancing rules, New York City enlisted thousands of clergy and community leaders to engage with at-risk communities and make the case for respecting social distancing. Rather than a backup solution after the use of force failed, this should have been the default. But it illustrates how police-free alternatives are possible. All it takes is political will. Abolishing the police means gradually curtailing the presence of police in our lives and in our communities, reducing the number of officers and patrols, replacing them with health and community initiatives. And because of the size of government pies, this is me talking, that it is a one or the other type of choice. Unless taxpayers are willing to fund both heavy policing and heavy restorative practices. But, in my opinion, it's sending the wrong message, or it's a very, very confused state of things. To, on one hand, punish, and the other, attempt to heal. And that is the current situation that, say, my county is taking, where there is a restorative justice program that I have participated in. And it's very good, but also very limited, in that it only covers the city of Albany, which is fine, but it doesn't cover anything that's a felony. And wouldn't you know it, there's a lot of things that are considered felonies. Hell, breaking parole then is bumped up to a felony. So many things are considered or could be converted into felonies, like adding two misdemeanor charges together. So this has been the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Check us out on Twitter and Facebook. Those are the social media profiles I have, Three Left Show. This show can be found on any podcast application. If you have one and my show isn't listed there, The Three Left Show, let me know via Facebook or Twitter. I've yet to have an email set up. That's something that's on my list to do. Otherwise, you can find a full archive of episodes at threelefts.news, along with ways of contacting me and some info about myself. Otherwise, thank you for joining me. This has been the first hour, and I'll play myself out with some music. War with drones, you can fight a war with loans, you can fight a war with gas or cans of paint, but don't you realize that the game is compromised if you think that this is something that it ain't? We got images of murder that don't manage to disturb an international order that is bordering absurd, and no one gets the freedom they were told that they deserve till they realize that freedom's not a noun. It's a verb, it's a verb. Freedom is a verb, something never finished, never done. It's something you must make, it's something you must take, it's something you must constantly become. Well, this weekend revolution, it's a radical inclusion. It's a holiday of popular revolt. It's the social interaction of inconsequential actions using faces to replace a silent vote. But lower pay and higher rents, another kind of violence, the violence of silence and of greed. It's the violence of feeling your irrelevance, revealing every way in which you never will be freed. It's a verb, an action and an urge, as fertile as the barrel of a gun. And it happens out of need, it's a fire and a seed, and its terrible potential has begun. Constantly in jeopardy, it's something you must loyally defend. But isn't it demeaning when your well-intended meanings mean your means will have to justify your ends? So improvise a barricade of furniture cascading as a carnival of helmets in the flood. For the bottles can be filled with either gasoline or lager or detergent that'll wash away your blood. It's a verb, it's a verb. Freedom is a verb. Something never finished, never done. It's something you can fake, and it's something that'll break if it ain't something that you constantly become. It's a verb, an action and an urge. So the next article is from the Underground Reporter. And this is takes the more roundabout argument for abolishing the police and also a discussion of the police itself as an institution, right? It's one thing to say that it's always going to be abusive, however it exists, and then another to explain why. So let's get into that. Now, this is published 4 years ago. Okay, so this is one of those, not maybe the organizer himself, but he's speaking to the group of organizers that have been advocating for abolishing the police for the last decade. So it's called the same kind of title, Maybe Abolishing America's Police Forces Isn't as Crazy as It Sounds. Are police necessary? Although this existential question also often produces a knee-jerk of course they are, who would protect us, a growing call for the abolition of police and working examples to back it up deserves more than scornful dismissal, particularly amid epidemic-level violence by agents of the state. Police are under no obligation to protect the public they punitively serve. A series of state and Supreme Court decisions stretching back more than three decades indisputably establish this fact. So the lingering question, who will protect us, is of no consequence to the case for dismantling every police department in the nation. So some background that isn't given here. Those Supreme Court decisions were basically that there are some lawsuits where someone was hurt while a police officer was present, and the case was like the police officer was there, he was on duty, and he did not protect me. He did not put his safety before my safety. And courts ruled that an officer is under no obligation to put their safety before your own. So they're not really that heroes. They're actually quite cowardly, as their job, their role, is to enforce the law, not to serve and protect. That's just a motto. On the contrary, police kill, maim, intimidate, harass, and generally brutalize the citizenry with alarming frequency, depending on who you are, of course, class-related, and rarely face consequences beyond a paid vacation, farcically termed administrative leave, for doing so. Rather than fight and solve violent crimes, police act as little more than heavily militarized code enforcers, or as David Graeber of the London School of Economics aptly terms, bureaucrats with weapons, protecting us from broken taillights, missing front license plates, and imperfect lane changes more often than from robbery, homicide, and rape. These are all things that stats bear out. This article then kind of uses Graeber as the main focus of the argument. I actually have one of his books, and it actually, this is quoted here, so I could quote the book myself, but this guy has already done the work. The book is called Utopia of Rules. Okay. It's mostly about bureaucracy, but but police obviously work into that because he calls them bureaucrats with weapons. Continuing on. Give police the equipment and weapons of war under the premise of fighting terrorism when terrorism is all but non-existent, and predictably they will go to war. As Abraham Maslow posited in 1966 in a concept known as the Law of the Instrument, I suppose it is tempting, if the only tool you have is a hammer, to treat everything as if it were a nail. I'm surprised that expression came from the 60s. Carrying on. We, the citizenry, are not nails to be forcibly and violently coerced in submission over the tiniest of nonviolent and inconsequential infractions. But, whether or not we're inclined to admit as such, that summarizes our current situation in the eyes of an overbearing state and its criminalization of, in essence, daily life. Now, one of the kind of situations that come to mind when you rely on the police, let's say the use of their force, or their ability to use force, monopoly of violence, is let's say you have someone who's breaking quiet hours, playing loud music, having a wild party next door and disrupting your peace. And obviously, the right of them, one person to swing their arms, ends not at your face, but actually towards your comfort level of your right to feel safe and not get punched in the face or hit in the face with a swinging arm. And that's kind of subjective, but still, quiet hours or a noise ordinance is something that I consider especially in certain areas, to be reasonable and something that's, you know, community rule. It's governance. How do you enforce it, right? You kind of need a community agreement of sorts. You need agreement between neighbors to treat each other with respect and respect each other's, whether it be their time, their ears, and their eyes. If there are people that don't want to respect others, asocial behavior, I don't consider violence to be the way of solving that, but some people are real dicks about it. Not wanting to respect you, even if you talk real nice, you could give them something, give a gift first to show that you do care about them, not just want to harangue them or complain, but you actually do mean well, and you mean them well. But why should you have to pay, bribe someone and make nice with them and be friends? But of course, that's how the antisocial behavior continues itself, and then violence is necessary. As long as we're thinking in terms of, like, why do I have to be nice to other people? Or where being nice is, like, the special condition that, like, I should have the right to be mean to others. But of course, then the noisy neighbor then has the right to do the same. But then everyone's just then concentrating on their own individual state of being, and well, that's not how societies work, unless you want to live out in a cabin out in the woods. Okay, digression over. How this police state cinched a noose-like grip on our nation, very bombastic language here, but that shows the difference between this and the Newsweek article. At this late date, arguably matters, but whether or not we're inclined to admit as much, that summarizes our current situation in the eyes of an overbearing state and its criminalization of, in essence, daily life. Okay, and while solutions run the gamut from individual officer liability insurance to the use of body cameras, forcing an on-call policy akin to that of fire departments to an overhaul of training policies, as it becomes apparent nothing will be done, the larger aforementioned existential question must come into play. Right? The stronger demand of abolishment comes because all these other things that could be done to make policemen less violent or make the police less a tool of violence have not been implemented at all. Here in Albany, the things that the council or the mayor have been doing in response to mass protests are the things that they should have done 10 years ago or 6 years ago when black man Dante Ivey was killed by the police. There were demands for a taser policy, for a use of force policy. Did the mayor or the council act? No, they didn't. Thus, the end result, the inevitable result, is a riot, is broken windows, right? Because we asked nice, well, it wasn't really nice, but we asked, we protested peacefully, nonviolently, non-militantly, not every day, and we were ignored. So yeah, we go. Are police a necessary element in an ordered, peaceful society? In short, the answer was no. Absolutely not. Largely because police spend such little time policing anything other than mostly ridiculous laws created solely for the purpose of revenue generation to justify their own existence. Graeber writes, "The police spend very little of their time dealing with violent criminals. Indeed, police sociologists report that only about 10% of the average police officer's time is devoted to criminal matters of any kind. Most of the remaining 90% is spent dealing with infractions of various administrative codes and regs. All those rules about how and where one can eat, drink, smoke, sell, sit, walk, and drive. If two people punch each other, or even draw a knife on each other, police are unlikely to get involved. Drive down the street in a car without license plates, on the other hand, and the authorities will show up instantly, threatening all sorts of dire consequences if you don't do exactly what they tell you." Now here's what should be coming to mind, is that if, sociologically speaking, only 10% of policemen's time is spent fighting crime, an actual, like, violent or nonviolent crime, consensual crime, non-consensual crime, then maybe they only need 10% of the current budget. That would be very essentialist, right? But hey, let's maybe 20% of what they do then? But that's kind of a conservative anti-government argument overall, is like if you give people a budget, they're going to spend it all to give the argument that they need that much money to spend. Continuing with Graver's quote, "The police then are essentially just bureaucrats with weapons. Their main role in society is to bring the threat of physical force, even death, into situations where it never would have been otherwise invoked, such as the enforcement of civil ordinances, such as the sale of untaxed cigarettes." The overcriminalization of, well, living has exploded prison populations and adversarial policing to a profoundly negative effect. In the beginning of 2015, the number of federal criminal laws exceeded 4,500, over 27,000 pages of U.S. federal code, with Congress creating crimes where none previously existed at a rate of 50 new laws each year, and that only covers federal law. Add state and local criminal codes, and it's estimated the average American unknowingly commits 3 felonies every day. Wow. According to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, quoting, "Our nation's addiction to criminalization backlogs our judiciary, overflows our prisons, and forces innocent individuals to plead guilty not because they actually are, but because exercising their constitutional right to a trial is prohibitively expensive and too much of a risk." Now, another point I'd like to make, that part of overfunding the police and that police are accepted as being the necessary vital service, unlike health care and summer programs for kids. Those things are, you know, that can be cut, but police can't. But because of that, and because they're overfunded or well-funded, when it comes to solving social problems around the city, I'm talking about my own city of Albany, the council relies on criminalizing things to solve the problems. Because, hell, we have a very well-funded hammer, and thus every problem looks like a nail. Or rather, the police are dependent upon to do something about that problem. Their ability to be city employees in the public realm, reacting to people's phone calls, complaints, and what have you, it puts a lot of responsibilities on them. And over the years, from, as explained, code enforcement, everything else, a lot of responsibilities are put on them, more and more and more and more. It really stresses them out, right? And I see it, and I empathize, actually. I think they do too much. That's why defunding is also about making the police and their ability to fight crime the actual priority, the only thing they need to care about. You know, when there's a robbery, they can put a whole week into casing the pawn shops and trying to solve the crime. You know, doing the thing you see in Law and Order. Because otherwise, detectives are doing all kinds of random grunt work that a social worker or even an Uber driver could do. Back to the article. "These purported crimes, however, largely have nothing at all to do with true harm committed against another, though brutal responses by police and filled beyond capacity prisons would have you thinking otherwise. With just 5% of the world's population, the U.S. incarcerates no less than a quarter of the world's prisoners. The stunning surplus of criminal law, coupled with the government's military equipment giveaway to law enforcement departments, which have little need of it, but they do like their toys, has put the populace in an altogether dangerous position of being 58 times more likely to be killed by an officer of the law than by a terrorist." Now, if you ask me what we should do with all that surplus military hardware, not being tongue-in-cheek here, but I'm also a little serious, I think we should make some kind of organized sport using them. Like, we could outfit all, since they're military vehicles, don't take all the guns off, but replace them with paintball guns or paintball-type ammo, and we could have some kind of sport where we have these simulated battles and teams kind of duke it out with the military vehicles and regular paintball guns, and we can have simulated war. We can have fake violence, though paintball's hurt, but you know, whatever. If it's all in vehicles, then it's not going to hurt anybody. You get hit with the big paint ammo, and boom, you're out. You know, it could be a lot of fun. I feel like, you know, the courses and the arenas that they battle on could be the golf courses, and since you know we don't need to maintain all those lawns, it would be a lot less wasteful and water intensive and all that stuff. I think, you know, there'd be fuel costs and stuff, of course. But I think it would still at least be a much more positive use. I'd rather be entertained rather than scared of such things driving down my street. Back to the article. Once an individual has a criminal record, possible future interactions with police become a risky endeavor. Indeed, it already doesn't take evidence of wrongdoing to put an officer on guard. But a criminal blip on someone's record during an otherwise routine traffic stop creates wholly unnecessary tension where none should exist. Especially if that crime was collecting rainwater, living off-grid, keeping rabbits in the backyard, or any of the untold number of patently absurd behaviors that are deemed forbidden by the state. And the scope of this article won't even touch on the untold tragedies fueled by the failed war on drugs. Loosely in line with the law of the instrument, citizens have become opportunities for revenue generation. As police patrol the streets searching for anyone stepping out of line with some misbegotten code. We are little more than adversarial dollar signs to these roving bands of armed enforcers of extraneous law. Targets to be plundered and pillaged, harassed, shaken down, to generate revenue, and therefore justify the continuation of big government. Now, to me, the absurdity is, and this is actually kind of an argument that the city uses when it comes to ticketing and so on, is that it actually doesn't bring in that much revenue. It certainly doesn't delay or defray the costs of the police department. You're lucky if it pays for the cost of the vehicles, you know. But it's just a minor amount. In the absence of policing, justice, prison, and criminal code reform, several viable options present themselves for consideration. Perhaps most imperatively among them, the complete abolishment of it. Deposit the populace would devolve into chaos and violence without police departments, ignores the chaos and violence wrought by police, or the violence that exists with the overfunded police. I mean, if the war on crime, after decade after decade after decade, you know, it's an unsolvable, it seems to be an unsolvable issue, right? How much closer to solving the crime problem are we? When, of course, the success of, you know, lowering crime is usually one of investment and economic growth and alleviating some poverty. But the, you know, catch-22 or the paradox is that these things don't happen without complete security. You know, the gangs or the poor or the infractions have to be driven out of an area before the investment can come in. And that's how gentrification works, where it's like, oh, it made the neighborhood so much better. Well, yeah, but you also arrested half of the men. As of 2011, according to the 2013 study by the Associate Dean of Eastern Kentucky University School of Justice Studies, a man named Victor Kepler, a mere 2 of 14 arrests out of every 14 arrests were for violent or property crime. If police truly existed to fight actual crime, not the overwhelming excesses of number of quote-unquote crimes created by lawmakers, departments would be slashed in staff dramatically. But the usual attitude that I'm seeing from the libs is that crime is crime, you know, whether it be the tagging of a wall, all of these consensual crimes that and so on, these are crimes. And crimes are crimes, which is, of course, tautology. It's just thinking, feeding back on itself, just saying, like, it's wrong because it's wrong, and we need to punish it. And that's how we deal with it. Make it go away, make it go away. Here's what that Dean of Social Justice Studies writes. If we take all the violent crimes reported to the police in 2011, we find that there are, citing FBI stats, about a million violent crimes. Since more than 885,000 people worked as sworn officers in that same year, there were 1.25 violent crimes reported for every police officer employed in the U.S. If crime were dispensed evenly across the nation's police, then this would mean that in 2011, each police officer would have to be responsible for investigating just over one single violent crime in the whole year. And since we know that a relatively small number of criminals are responsible for the vast majority of crime, each cop would be responsible for even fewer criminals. After the highly controversial deaths by the police of Michael Brown and Eric Garner in 2014, the call for police reform intensified exponentially. While undoubtedly well-intentioned in motive, years of begging nicely for the broken system to fix itself have, to be expected, fallen on deaf ears. Abolishing police entirely might reek of radicalism to a nation cowed by constant government fear propaganda, but considering how little violence is present in our current society, compared to just decades ago, examples already in place prove the concept has teeth. Trained and unarmed intervention teams consisting of civilians, often former violent offenders themselves, those are those peace teams mentioned, can and do defuse potentially violent conflicts in their own neighborhoods. These have been implemented in LA, Detroit, including my own city. It's done by an organization that was called Cure Violence. Now they're called SNUG, which is like an anti-gun violence name. Indeed, conflict resolution as a community program has effectively prevented criminal activity, improved neighborhood relations, reduced gang violence, and resolved, without the involvement of police or courts, crimes which have already occurred. Ethan Uecker, co-founder of Circles and Ciphers, quoting him, a leadership training, a conflict resolution program for young men who have been in prison, jail, or a gang, which began in Chicago, facilitates peace circles. Through peace circles, will likely invoke images of stoned hippies around a campfire for many, but the concept has done the extraordinary in a community once awash in violence and gang activity. And just one anecdotal example Uko offered to the College Reader recently. There was a robbery at the store in the community. One of the people at the store whose stuff was taken said, look, I don't want to call the cops. Is there anything we can do? They found on Facebook that this young person was selling their stuff, and that young person happened to go to a school where we'd done some of our circles. So I knew a teacher at the school and could say, hey, this is where we're at. Eventually, the robber and the robbed were brought together in an attempt to resolve the wrongdoing. That young person ended up returning what he had that hadn't been sold, and then working at the shop in restitution for everything else. But then it turned out he really liked working there. And after this agreement was over, he continued to go there and volunteer. There was a relationship built. That relationship among community members can act as a compelling deterrent against crime, or even any asshole behavior, if you ask me. The better one knows a neighbor, the less likely they are to rob or victimize them. This cannot be said of police in 2016, as officers often don't live in the neighborhoods they police, which creates a degree of separation and personal investment from the ultimate outcome of any interaction. Decreasing the hesitation of to act violently in the encounter. Now, of course, that's one of those other, this creates openings for the kind of reforms that could happen, you know, the requiring police in a city to live in the neighborhood they police. But again, that's one of those half measures that maybe or maybe not actually reduces police violence or abuse, just as having more black faces there helps, because it's really its institution itself. Notice none of these arguments for abolishing police criticize officers as individuals. Except for an obviously growing number of bad apples, spoiling the bunch, many officers choose policing as an occupation for protecting and serving in mind. But that arguably laudable goal is a vapid remnant of what has become policing for profit at the expense of communities nationwide. And unless an altogether unlikely revamping of overcriminalization takes place soon, officers serve no one but state and corporate interests. Thus, those who argue police put their lives on the line miss that they do so at the behest of the system oppressing us, all to meet its financial goals. No perfect solution to police violence exists, and in the absence of wholesale reform, abolishing American police might be our only realistic and suitable solution. Now, this is interesting to read now, because now we have a much new movement that is getting the reactions from Democratic mayors and councils to actually do some of those reforms. But it's entirely promising, again, looking at Minneapolis, which is where the most rioting occurred, that the council has had the strongest reaction in calling for a police force that is maybe just 10% crime fighting. And the rest will be all the other things. $10 million for peace circles. Imagine what those hippies can do with $10 million. Imagine what kind of mental health care facilities could be open. We could have safe ejection sites. the safe injection sites being the place for drug treatment and safe drug use. Things that are all about the harm reduction. Since that's the goal, right? But it's assumed that a strong police force and well-funded, well-equipped, reduces harm. But this article and many other sources and sociological studies, the entire profession of sociology says, nope, not really harm reduction. So I like that article because it talked about some of the things that do replace the police, for the most part, besides the crime-fighting situation, because, as I said, the police are given all of these responsibilities that are better handled by all these other institutions, some of which exist, some of which are yet to exist or be promoted wholesale. My local school district has been doing more restorative justice things or alternatives to suspension. That's positive. They're kind of really, over time, phasing it in. But now, two pieces going deep into two of those aspects. So first, the mental health crisis response team. So here's a quick story from Oregon, also filed quite a bit of time ago. An alternative to police, mental health team response to emergencies in Oregon, filed by the CBS affiliate in Eugene. When a mental health-related 911 call comes in, a specialized team in Eugene, Oregon rolls out. Quoting, "Pretty much everyone we see is for one reason or another in a state of crisis," says Manning Walker. Walker is a medic, and Laurel Levitskis is a mental health crisis manager. The pair are members of a mobile health mental health crisis intervention team called CAHOOTS, which stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. They answer calls like suicide interventions and overdoses. They're unarmed and most of the time without police backup. We always move as a team, says Levitskis. They told CBS News on exclusive ride-along, their first call was for a woman they've met before, who they believe is a schizophrenic. She said her name was Kayla. Quoting her, "I like CAHOOTS. They help you in your time of need, when you are hungry and certain things like that." CAHOOTS was founded in 1989, so they've been around for a long time, at least in Oregon. Last year, they responded to nearly 23,000 calls in Eugene and Springfield. Denver is starting its own version of CAHOOTS. City leaders from Oakland, Olympia, Washington, and even New York City are all considering similar pilot programs. Quoting, "We handle almost 20% of the entire public safety call volume for our area." So there's another, 20% of the stuff police do could be handled by this non-armed professional team. The program manager is named Tim Black, and he's now being quoted. "But there was such a dramatic need coming in through the 911 and non-emergency lines that there was a need for there to be this kind of behavioral health first response." The CAHOOTS team members are trained to de-escalate when responding to a mental health crisis. A recent study found 25 of 50% of fatal officer-involved shootings involve someone with a severe mental illness, a stat that I've already mentioned this time. They don't need jail. What they need is to be able to be de-escalated from their crisis, talked down. They need a ride to a mental health facility or medical care facility or wrapped around with services. That's what the people need. They don't need to be going to jail every time. This is a quote from the Eugene police chief. "This is a new way to protect and serve and maybe save a life." Spoken like a true CBS affiliate report. So there you go. There's something. And how they operate. Moving on. Finally, going abroad, but this is actually for the safety, security aspects of the police. The final 10%, if you were. So let's say we've taken care of the drug crime, ending the drug war and focusing on treatment and health care and safe ejection sites and harm reduction. Same when it comes to homelessness and the consensual crimes they cause, or the ruckus, or the quality of life crimes that they're called. Let's go to Kurdistan. Let's go to Rojava, the Democratic Confederalist Experiment. If you think the Seattle Autonomous Zone is great, You should learn about Rojava because, well, that's just a... This is a autonomous zone that is the size of Rhode Island. So this is from the blog of Hazarin Aziz, Reflections of a Kurdish Feminist. I think I read her before. She's kind of my go-to source. But now she weighs in at this time. How to abolish the police. Lessons from Rojava. Let's begin. In the last week, we have seen another horrific case of police brutality emerge in the U.S. with the senseless murder of George Floyd. Following inadequate police response, public outrage ensued, as the four police officers responsible were only fired without further consequence. Well, now that's been changed quite a bit, a number of times actually, but this is because a mass riot and protest occurred across multiple cities. Common cry around the idea of no justice, no peace. Now, I want to actually talk about that for a moment, that the chant, no justice, no peace, can have multiple meanings, right? You know, so if I'm saying it, nerdy white dude, it's kind of a warning that since we're a society without justice, that there will not be peace from the marginalized. Conversely, it could actually mean the opposite, that since we're not a peaceful society, we go to war, we make war on our own communities, we incarcerate a quarter of the world's prison population, that means that we are also a society without justice. In that sense, that's the chant as a statement of fact. It could also be a warning that if you don't give us justice, then we're not going to be peaceful any longer. And in that way, then it becomes a threat. Again, depending on who's saying it. When I'm saying it, it's a warning for the person who would be using it as a threat. Back to the article. This phenomenon raises the essential question of how a system deeply entrenched in a bloody history, founded in white supremacy, capitalism, colonialism, ever provide true and meaningful justice. Can it? Some call for police reforms. Others have called for redistribution of funds, defunding. Some have argued that abolishing the police is the best option, as I have done. Many, even on the left, cannot imagine such a system ever being viable. Yet this system already exists in Rojava. Happy. The autonomous self-administrative region of North Syria. In Rojava, the combination of Ayesis, that's the term for it, and HPC, their civil defense forces, they work together in a symbiotic relationship to provide safety and security to, quote-unquote, the community. Asayish, I'm going to call them the Asayish, work as traffic controllers, arrest criminals, they protect victims of domestic violence, they serve as security guards at main governing buildings, and control the inflow of people and goods from one canton, you know, area to the next. The HPC, in contrast, are people in a given neighborhood trained in basic security. They only patrol their own neighborhood unless they protect the people during festivals, martyr ceremonies, local events, and nightly watches. The purpose of both forces is explicitly the protection of the people, especially from outside threats such as terrorist forces. It is always the HPC that protects their neighborhood, never the Sayish. The Sayish protects the city, the HPC, the community. Both organizations consist of at least 40% women, if not more. Now, in this case, the policy recommendation of the actual living embodiment of democratic confederalism, as it exists in the world, is that the functions of security and the police need to be separated into two categories. The one, the people that protect the city, and those that protect the community. Police are told to do both. Again, an overloading of responsibilities that they cannot possibly carry out effectively, fairly, and so on. The possibilities of instituting hierarchies of power and authority are considerably reduced in this alternative method. The people are the protectors of the people, those that they live with and interact with daily. The proximity of the security forces to the community being drawn from their own neighborhood ensures that violations do not occur. In the same way mentioned before about they actually have real relationships. They're not just statistics to be logged. Now I'll do another aside, because it just came to me that that thought that I didn't think of before, that one of the other functions of the police that my law degree-holding friend mentions is that one of their main responsibilities, or as functions the police, as the professional witness, right? When a crime occurs, their main and first task is to show up and get down the facts so that they can be related later at trial or another court of justice. They are trusted and trained to take depositions, testimony, and ask the right questions and so on. At least that's how it's projected and how it's done. They're a professional witness. And that, too, is also doesn't require holding a gun. It's something that could be done by a separately trained team, perhaps with a law background. So that's something else to take into account in this future without police, or thinking about reducing these responsibilities and having a more diverse set of services than just having a police department. Back to Rojava. The proximity of the security forces to the community, being drawn from their own neighborhood, ensures that these violations don't occur. Any violations. Violations of community rules. Where do they occur? Where they do occur, community mechanisms of justice, honor, and restoration are immediately activated through local communes. Monopoly of this process is further prevented by encouraging everyone to participate through a roster system. Anyone can volunteer. This explicitly includes the elderly, particularly women, as sources of civil protection. There is nothing more empowering. Nothing restores the soul of a traumatized, war-torn country, sorry, community, than seeing the matriarchs of a neighborhood stand confidently at street corners wielding AK-47s for the protection of the people. Unlike the terrifying images of police brutality in the U.S., these images do not inspire fear and terror. They inspire communal confidence, pride, dignity, self-respect, belonging. Of course, in Rojava, the elderly, that they do have to take on more responsibility due to the fact that most of the young men and women are still fighting on the front lines in the war against ISIS. The social ecology, buzzword, of this system is protected through promotion of women's participation, deep respect for multiculturalism, and the sacredness of ecology. The system is established through concerted efforts towards democratizing education, unlearning within society towards these patriarchal, these other hierarchies. It is not enough to simply create alternative institutions without working at significant educational efforts within society. This is what's usually missing in America. We create the new thing, but we're not including it in school curriculum so that every new citizen, every graduate of high school knows how, A, what a peace circle is and how to comport oneself in one. That's why doing them in the schools first is probably a good way to go, but eventually it needs to be, everyone. It needs to be like the new jury duty. In order to re-educate society, people often enter academies. So, when socialism comes, is it re-education camps? No. But academies have been founded that people go to for 1, 2, 3 months at a time. This is based on a volunteer basis, but also based on each branch of government institution. For example, the education ministry will roster a group of 30 teachers at a time to enter academies. People continue to be paid during this process. That's important. Women with children can take their children along for free childcare as they spend weeks learning about civic duties, democratic rights, gender liberation, ecological sustainability, the history of capitalism, much more. Everyone participates in the daily cleaning, cooking, management of that education center. Thus, you don't need to provide staff and a whole bloated budget, a bureaucracy of professionals to manage the school. Interestingly, I think it's usually conservatives that mention or promote the idea that students should be forced to clean up after themselves, aka do the custodial work at school. This is usually framed as like taking, posed by like you're taking time away from them actually learning. Children should be enjoying their childhood, not doing work. But this is undercut by the fact that school is becoming more and more like work with overtesting and whatnot. and a lack of play and gauging activities. So in this case, the conservative value of cleaning up after yourself is balanced by how democratic and goddamn leftist and radical it is. Now, so now going into the source of this ideology, what Rojava is doing, talking about democratic confederalism. However, before the establishment of this alternative system was made possible, alternative ideology, it was needed to, an alternative ideology, a way of actually thinking about problems, needed to emerge that would provide a blueprint for this ideal, this democratic society. The system works based on the Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan's theory of democratic confederalism. This in turn was inspired by the American theorist Murray Bookchin's social ecology. Buzzword. One of the foundational values of democratic confederalism is an anti-hierarchy approach to communal structures and coexistence. What does that mean? To me, a fusion of the best of socialism and anarchism and ecology. So, if asked, what is my ideology? What is my, you know, democratic confederalist? Close enough. The other two compound words is libertarian municipalism. Essentially the same things. They're describing the same set of things. Let's see, there's a quota of 40 to 60% participation across all administrative and decision-making structures. This also includes the co-chair system of all leadership positions being held by one male, one female. Essentially a system based on active promotion of equality across ethnic, religious, and decision-making process is fundamental for any anti-hierarchical system to work. The system is also established on the foundation that institutions with a high level of women's participation tend to be more inclusive and democratic in nature. The extent to which society can be, and this is quoting Öcalan himself, a political prisoner of Turkey, by the way. The extent to which society can be thoroughly transformed is determined by the extent of the transformation attained by women. Similarly, the level of women's freedom and equality determines the freedom and equality of all sections of society. Thus, democratization of women is decisive for the permanent establishment of democracy and secularism. For a democratic nation, women's freedom is of great importance, too, as liberated women constitutes liberated society. Liberated society, in turn, constitutes a democratic nation. Rojava's ideological orientation attempts to subvert everything that we know about the state, about peace, liberation, and coexistence. Continuing with the explanation of the ideology itself, and it kind of goes to the difference between the bedtime story and the waking up story at the beginning of the episode. Rojava's ideological orientation attempts to subvert everything that we know about the state, about peace, liberation, and coexistence. It is explicitly anti all hierarchies of all forms. Since the inception of the Westphalian system, which divided and colonized minorities, have lived under the artificial and authoritarian nation-states. Westphalia created the nation-state system of Europe. An exclusionary, violent, hierarchical system that teaches the diversity is the antithesis of patriotism and nationalism. Diversity must be sacrificed at the bloody altar of the nation-state with one language, one flag, one identity, one national myth. This history taught the oppressed, the dispossessed, and the stateless that only attaining a state can bring about liberation. This process, however, would naturally lead to the oppression of other minorities that would fall within the borders of that state. Instead, through Bookchin and Öcalan, an alternative blueprint emerged in which primordial hatreds and long-established ethno-religious cleavages could be addressed through a radical grassroots model. The model of democratic confederalism unites a rich mosaic of cultures and religions together in a more enriched society, which does not attempt to erase them to serve the interests of a dominant group. Many leftists have made the mistake of saying that this implies that all expressions of national identity should be erased, that all Kurdishness, all Armenian, Assyrian, Yazidi nationalism should not be expressed. This is a deeply Orientalist, a Western perspective. Asking Yazidis to stop being Yazidi or Kurds to stop being Kurds merely serves the interest of imperial and genocidal forces, and that have established their ideologies on the eraser of deeply oppressed minorities, be they blacks or First Nations. In contrast, in Rojava, this means that all cultures should leave freely, expressing the rich culture of their ancient colors, cultures, and other likewise free existing ones, subcultures, like queerness. This means explicit respect for multiculturalism, not asking colonized or oppressed ethno-religious minorities to form an alternative citizenship based on denial of all that they have fought to preserve. In Rojava, this has meant that schools are run based on three dominant languages. Kind of goes into that, nitty-gritty of Rojava. But we're talking about police reform here, so let's skip ahead. Oh yeah, and this article includes pictures of the patrolling grandmas with their AK-47s. Pointing out that Rojava, of course, have not dismantled all forms of racism and class yet, but it's working on it. As Murray Bookchin would write, if we do not do the impossible, we shall be faced with the unthinkable. You know, if we don't abolish the police, we're just going to have to keep accepting that the deaths and murders that police commit will continue. You know, if we can't imagine a healthcare system that actually addresses the pandemic properly, we're going to have to basically accept that the death toll that we're getting is a fact of life. That seems to be what many states are preparing to do. As Kurds, we watch across the Middle East as the black communities and allies throughout the United States rise up. We cheer their revolutionary courage, their unwavering commitment to justice and desire for freedom. Their cry for justice echoes across our own hearts, both beating to the drum of freedom denied. And though our chains may be different, we ultimately face the same oppressive system that continues to kill us and impose various violences on us. With Rojava, we've ensured that an alternative world is possible. Now we must let solidarity be the bridge that unites us.